Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 15th. The governor attended a gathering of army leaders from 32 countries this week, just after his land board delivered a setback on the first of a number of military land leases that are up for renewal. We hear from him and from the army about the need to maintain an area to train troops here in the islands. We take you to an East Honolulu neighborhood where a pilot project is using landscapers and a goat herd to reduce fire hazards. What can we learn from other animals about human health? Plus, the attraction to the forbidden, we highlight an upcoming event of stories about kapu places, waikapu, music, chants, and dance about those places off limits. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, the U.S. Army played host to LANPAC 2025. It's when top brass from countries like Australia, Korea, Philippines, Singapore, and Indonesia gather to talk about how to keep the upper hand when it comes to military deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region. The conference drew record attendance from top generals from more than 30 countries. It winds up today. And earlier this week, the commanding general of Army Pacific, Ronald Clark, talked about the importance of land power.
Land forces comprise the vast majority of military forces in this region, and we stand together here at LANPAC as evidence of those close ties. Second, land forces, in particular the United States Army, is working hard to gain positional advantage. We're doing that with decisive land power to deter aggression in the Indo-Pacific. Specifically, aggression by China, so that we can maintain regional security, stability, and reassure our allies and partners. As directed by Admiral Paparo, the commander of U.S. Indo-PACOM, our mission is to prevail in competition, crisis, and conflict. And LANPAC is an investment in our ability to do just that, prevail.
Prevail. Well, where the U.S. Army did not prevail was at the State Land Board. Last week, members heard an earful, mostly pushback in a seven-hour hearing. The Land Board voted 5-1 to reject an environmental impact study on the Pohakaloa land lease on the Big Island. The military leases the state land for just a dollar. The Army says it's the only remaining place where it conducts live fire training for its troops and for the state's first responders. But the community has resisted, with some arguing the lands should not be renewed. Others argue the activity is contrary to the use of conservation lands and point to the cleanup still going on at Makua and Koho'olawe. Here's Ashley Obrey testifying on behalf of Piha, a group, a hui of Native Hawaiian practitioners. She said she's observed shell casings and debris on planned inspections at Pohakaloa.
It kind of begs the question, what else is out there? What do we not know? An EIS is supposed to be a document that provides necessary information for decision makers and for the public to understand the potential environmental consequences of an action. However, this EIS does not function as a disclosure document, does not comply with the letter, spirit, and intent of the law, and it has been deemed unsatisfactory by your own staff and division, which is really important. So ultimately, accepting a deficient document that would facilitate the use of these lands, conservation lands, trust lands, in a manner that's inconsistent with the law is really the opposite of mala ma'aina, opposite of your duties, so please reject it.
Another testifier took issue with the treatment of Ivy on the land and the potential for undiscovered remains.
For the record, I am James Jake, Le Mamahu, Crowningburg, Maiaoho. You all know well the kuleana that I carry to protect some of our most sacred Ivy. It is clear, just from the executive summary and what we've already heard this morning, that there is a lack of content to the document and the process itself. And with this evidence of written testimony, I think you already have enough to deny this EIS, but I want to focus you on the importance of the Ivy that are there. There's been no proper archaeological survey. We had Ivy for generations there, and my lines go deep to this area and this island as well. And the importance of that must outweigh everything else.
The land board characterized the EIS as inadequate. Here's General Army Pacific Ronald Clark's response to the setback.
Our ability to live and train in Hawaii is very important, not just to the Army and to U.S. Army Pacific, but to national security. This is an issue of defense of the homeland, which, as you well know, Hawaii is a key part of that strategically. So the Board of Land and Natural Resources made a decision. We accept that decision and look forward to continuing to negotiate in good faith with the state of Hawaii to come to some workable solutions with regard to land retention. It's a lengthy process. The EIS, Environmental Impact Study, is just a part of that. And so again, it's our ability to be able to work together with our partners and allies, because it's not just the United States Army that trains here. It's the Joint Force. It's a number of our allies across a number of training areas in the state of Hawaii, to include our National Guard, who born and bred here for the most part. We have to be good stewards of the land. We understand that, and good partners in this process.
And this morning, we talked to Governor Josh Green. He began by addressing the Army audience about the lease issue.
The land is truly precious to us, as everyone knows, and you can't come up short as far as protecting the land here. And in the end, we won't. You know, the truth of the matter is, it's a very complicated discussion. It's gone on for decades and decades and decades, and everyone has important points to make. We can't walk away from security of the nation, and they do need to train in the region. I acknowledge that. And there's no way that we can deflect anyone's concerns about the environment. So the environmental impact studies will continue. It's of course, possible. The military has the right to challenge our decision. What I think is more likely is we will have other tracks of negotiation. And if ultimately, like, a land swap is fully proposed, I'll get input from everybody. And a land swap would have to be very thoughtful for the people of Hawaii. It would have to give us extra capacity to preserve the land. I'm sure it would result in much more land coming to us, and we could then protect our natural and cultural resources. So that's out there. But I do want to mention, and I think I said it once before, the federal government has certain capacity, which I don't love, and that's to use the nuclear option and simply eminent domain the land. I don't think it will come to that. I don't even think that will really be threatened, but it is out there as a possibility, and that's why I have little choice but to always work with people. And I know that can be frustrating for some that may, you know, have a true purity test on how we deal with the military or how we deal with any presidential administration, conservative or liberal. But I have no choice but to try to keep, you know, good lines of communication going so that extreme measures aren't used, and that would be an extreme measure. So that's my approach. I do think that I can get a very good compromise done by 2029 if people still have me and I'm the one negotiating this, but it does have its stresses applied to it, and I think the military was expressing that while they were here.
Well, you know, when I checked with the military this morning, you know, they said that, you know, that's not on their radar right now. You know, I think they want to work within the system. But certainly we heard loud and clear on Friday that Hawaii needs to broker a better deal. You know, $1 for such a long lease. And then the concern about cleanup, right? Because we saw what happened with Red Hill. And, you know, we take the military for face value and find out later what they were telling us was just not true. It does erode that trust.
It does. Look, I'm in complete agreement with what you just said. The deal has to, and I've been expressing this for the last 2.5 years, has to be very favorable, no matter what it is, for the people of Hawaii, especially from a conservation standpoint. And more land has to come back to Hawaii. More land has to be protected. Real resources have to be dedicated to cleanup. And there are some pretty extraordinary possibilities for us regarding Makua Valley, regarding large tracts of land on the Big Island that probably can come back to the state of Hawaii. So, you know, I'm personally optimistic. And when the presidents change from time to time, sometimes their negotiators change a little too, but we have been very steady. I'm not overly worried about it now, but I'm glad that we're focusing on the environment. That's very important.
The Army said they do intend to release the environmental impact statements for the Oahu land leases as well, you know, Makua, Kahuku, Poamoho. And the military has made statements that they don't plan to do any more live training over at Makua. Anything you want to say about those land leases?
I think that we will be able to settle pretty pretty straightforwardly. I don't think that that's going to be difficult, and I think that I'm going to work very hard. In fact, I don't think I'm doing it to have a global agreement by the end, because I don't want other governors to have to inherit this issue for the next decade, two decades. I'd like to resolve these matters, and I'm the kind of person who likes to be able to move on and then take advantage of good results. And that, you know, that's why we're trying to advance things like housing for everyone or healthcare for everybody. You know, I don't want these same problems to linger, and they would linger if we don't address, you know, some of the land leases here, Kauai, and so on.
I understand that there are different paths for negotiating these leases, you know, based on something that could be very simple or something more complex, as we have at Pohakaloa.
That is true. And we have a whole committee led by Scott Glenn and then my inner circle, plus input from the MAC, input from the military at all times, input from past leaders. You know, I appreciate people giving me input on these matters. There's pretty clear consensus that there is a need to have significant training capacity in our region. Look, it's just the reality of the times. But there's no reason that we shouldn't get a fantastic deal and that we shouldn't get it for all the islands, because this is an era where, you know, environmental protection is more important to me than ever before. I mean, that's why we passed the climate impact fee. That is completely landmark. I mean, we now have impact dollars coming from travelers that's going to go $100 million a year, plus whatever we bond, which could be billions of dollars a year, to deal with climate and to deal with the land. And this is important to me. So, the deal we ultimately have with the military, especially if it significantly shrinks the footprint and everyone can get a semi-successful settlement out of this, is good because we move on. Then we can preserve the land. We can clean up the land. We have resources. More beautiful places are preserved. All of that is good. But if this lingers forever, I really don't want people to have the same concerns. We have new concerns to deal with.
I think the DOD, you know, has indicated its commitment to, you know, defense out in the Indo-Pacific area. This region may be spared the deep cuts that, you know, Europe is experiencing, but they are moving to roll back regulations within the EPA and cut staff. And, you know, I don't know, how concerned are you? Because we saw how, in the case of Red Hill, the EPA as a regulator was able to hold the military, the Navy, to task, you know, for their cleanup. And so, yeah, if there's less of that oversight, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I am worried about that. Some of the cuts at HHS, at the EPA, they're too deep. And they will hamstring the current administration's capacity to do regular things, things that they have not politicized. And that's a mistake. We have to be able to deal with pandemics. We have to be able to deal with spills or lead in the water in other states. We have to be able to take up these challenges. And if their cuts are too deep because they, you know, have a semi-obsession with deregulation, then a lot of people are going to get hurt. In fact, it's going to also cost more. There are going to be class action lawsuits. There's going to be harm to people. There's going to be collateral damage that simply just is actually more expensive. And so I constantly impress upon the president and their cabinet, let's get a return on investment. Even if we differ in our ideologies on issues, let us as governors prove that the return on investment is worth it with some of these programs. And I'm going back to D.C. again, I believe flying out Monday, and I'll be testifying in front of a very significant committee. This is a Homeland Security committee. Basically, I'm the guy to go and push back on, I think they're calling it the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, to say, don't cut too deep on vaccinations. Don't cut too deep on programs that can prevent these outbreaks, because if you do those things, we all hurt. And that point can be applied to a lot of the different disciplines, even to the Department of, you know, the IRS, the taxation folks. They're making a mistake to just get rid of it. So there has to be a counterbalance. That's why I go to D.C. This was a formal invitation in this case. And I'll be the only person testifying against what will probably be 5 or 7 individuals that are aiming to undermine good public health and good environmental protection. But it gives me an opportunity to speak up on behalf of Hawaii's values. And by the way, I'll have side conversations and try to, you know, get them to moderate their position a little bit, especially on Medicaid. That's one of the main reasons I'm going, to make sure that I am impressing upon them that Medicaid cuts should not occur, if at all possible, we can streamline the program a little bit, but cutting services and cutting resources will hurt vulnerable people. And that I can't, you know, accept. So, look, it's a dynamic moment because this administration really pushes hard, but we have to stand our ground a little bit on things like Red Hill, on the leases, on our public health.
And, you know, Governor, you talk about the cuts and the reduction of staff. How are we doing on the Higher Hawaii? Any sense as to how many federal employees have put in applications?
Yeah, it's amazing. Not all of them are federal employees because we opened it up for other people that have been riffed from positions or have been having a difficult time finding jobs. But as you know, we have about 15% minimum, sometimes as high as 30% vacancy rate in a lot of parts of the government. We've had 4,107 applications so far as of today. And, you know, we're hiring them as we go. You know, we're keeping a ton of people's applications. Some people are applying that haven't yet been let go. They're putting their names in, anticipating a possible firing from the federal government. So we will be able to, in a rolling fashion, if they need to quickly get a job, we can do it. And we did get a little bit of a lucky break. You know, I won't deny making that settlement with pharmaceutical companies, bringing $700 million to our state came at a good time. We approved that, and many mahalos to Attorney General Lopez and her team for putting the final touches on that settlement, and with Rick Fried's group. This is a great thing for us because it protects us, it buffers us against some cuts, and also helps me to hire people where we have need. So a lot of good things are happening, while some things which are, you know, really freaking people out are also happening on the mainland. You know, I will say, everyone, we're going to be okay, but I acknowledge the fact that it can be somewhat traumatic to watch day in and day out all this extra pressure on people's lives.
All right, Governor. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning.
My pleasure. Hey, thank you for including me.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we spoke to just before we went on the air this morning. And as we mentioned, the Army leases for Oahu are also soon up for renewal. Tomorrow, the environmental impact statements for Makua, Kahuku, and Pomoho are expected to be released. So stay tuned.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com. Next month, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton series presents a local jazz lineup you won't want to miss. Each Saturday in June, enjoy live performances from the Honolulu Jazz Quartet, Noel Okimoto, DeShannon Higa's Quad Pod, and the Sean Conley Quartet. Learn more at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA. Support for HPR comes from Carrier Hawaii, serving the islands with HVAC products and services, featuring ductless and central systems for residential customers. Dealer listing at carrierhawaii.com.
For a decade now, the use of landscapers, or sheep, to keep the grass down around solar panels have been in use here in the islands. But now the use of not just sheep, but goats is being tested to reduce the fire threat to high-risk neighborhoods. Here with the story is HPR's Mark Liddell. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good, good. So where did you go for this story?
Yeah, I went to into East Oahu, out in Waialae-iki. There's this really small park. It's about 3.5 acres, called the Laukahi Slopes Mini Park. It's really small, and yeah, over the weekend I visited because about 100 animals were released into the park. About 80 sheep, and then a little later, about 20 goats, and they are there to eat the vegetation out in the park. It's sort of unmaintained, but it is very much like a fire mitigation effort. And so, yeah, I think for the next week or so, they'll be there. And I should say that the funding for this particular project was from a grant by FireWise USA. It's sort of this national program that helps local communities prepare and prevent wildfires. And, you know, in this case, obviously, managing vegetation is kind of a big deal for preventing fires. I talked to Elizabeth Kiefer, who lives near the park, and she's the chair for the neighborhood's FireWise group.
It is super overgrown. It is a mini park, so city and county comes by every, I think it's every 2 weeks, and they mow a little bit, but most of the park is unmaintained. So our community adopted the park about a year ago, and as part of that contract, we can take care of the park and we can manage it and do things to it. So the first thing we did as a FireWise community is try to cut down some of the flammable halicoa trees and cut down some of the vegetation. It didn't really make a dent. FireWise gave us some money. They have grants, and we rented a huge dumpster, and neighbors came out, and we tried to help clean up the park a little bit, but that didn't last very long.
Yeah, that's the trick, right? You gotta keep it up.
Yeah, and you know, part of this also was, you know, the terrain she had mentioned is kind of difficult. So like getting weed whackers and like lawnmowers, it's hilly, and there are a lot of rocks. A lot of areas like rocky. There's some like open field area, but it's kind of hard for people to get in there and actually do a good job. So part of the reason for the sheep and the goats is that they can just go everywhere and kind of clear the path. And I talked with some of the folks involved. Yes, just. Most recently was yesterday, and they said, you know, they've already cleared like a pretty big patch of it because it's been about a week. One of the reasons why they're doing this, obviously, is for fire mitigation. People who live nearby say that around August, towards the end of summer, the grasses and the plants get really, really dry. And obviously, that's kind of a concern for lighting fires. I talked to Kiefer again, and she said that she had found out about using goats and sheep because a neighborhood on the Big Island has done something similar before.
When you're in the process of becoming FireWise certified, it's really great because you have all of these community resources, and we meet quarterly. Different neighborhoods talk about what they're doing. So I learned that a neighborhood on the Big Island used sheep and goats to maintain and take down the fire risk in an unmaintained part of their neighborhood. And I just Googled to find out if there was a grazing company on Oahu, and that's how I met Raya.
And I should say that's Raya Olson, who runs Oahu Grazers. That's a family-run business on the North Shore. And what she does with her husband and her family is they have already been doing or sending out sheep and goats to solar farms primarily to eat the grass under there. That's something that they've been doing for a while. But you know, the reason why it's notable for this project is because it's maybe the first time that the city is doing it, and at a city park and on Oahu. So it's kind of novel there. And you know, there's a little bit of concern, as you'll hear, about it being so close to people. It's right in the park is right in the middle of a neighborhood. There are houses everywhere, and it's near the street on both sides of the park. But so it's very new, and this project, there's a lot to learn about how to do this in such a populated area. And on Saturday, I spoke with Raya. Again, she's with Oahu Grazers, who are raising the sheep and goats. And she and her husband and their kids were there on Saturday, and they let the animals into the park.
I told everybody it's this really like open-ended science project. We don't exactly know. It's so hard to look at a space and know exactly how long it's going to take. It's all according to the density of the grass and the forages with the stocking rate and the size. So this one seems small. It's only 3.5 acres, but it's quite dense. And there's a lot of woody halicoa all at the top. We would like to make a faster impact and get out instead of having them here for too long. We also run the risk of neighborhood dogs and predators, and also those two-legged sticky finger predators who like to steal stuff. We have that all the time. So it makes us nervous being right in the middle of the community.
I didn't think about the threat of dogs, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of things to kind of consider because, again, it's so close to the neighborhood. But everybody's hoping that it'll work out because, you know, the sheep and goats, obviously, they help reduce flammable grasses, but they also help the soil. They poop and you know, they just fertilize things.
It, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, their hooves, like, break down the soil so it can retain water a little more. And it can also be kind of affordable. I was talking to some folks, and it sounds like it would be cheaper to use the goats than do things like construct a fire break or keep on sending people out there to do kind of an inefficient job.
Right, right. Yeah, no, but kudos for them for trying this. We'll see how well it works.
Yeah, they're out there for about a week more, so hopefully it does.
All right, okay. Well, thanks so much, Mark.
For sure.
We've been talking to HRS Mark Liddell. He has news of a pilot project to use goats and sheep to reduce fire risk in an East Honolulu neighborhood. And while we're on the subject of animals, what could giraffes teach us about heart disease or monk seals about glaucoma? Barbara Natterson Horowitz is a professor of medicine at UCLA and faculty member at Harvard University. She studies species-spanning medicine, a field that draws inspiration from animals to improve human health. She recently gave a lecture at the University of Hawaii John A. Burns School of Medicine as part of the Hawaii chapter of the Alpha Omega Alpha Medical Honor Society. And during her visit, she stopped by our studios and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender. She begins with the invitation she received from a former student to come to Hawaii.
I always love when I get invitations to go to medical schools, and definitely from one of my former students, but life's busy and I can't always say yes, but he wisely included a paragraph or a couple of sentences at the bottom that said, if you come, we, the medical students in the AOA chapter, will give you a surfing lesson. And I had a moment, I checked my calendar, it was open, and I thought, I could visualize a picture of me with a surfboard. I've never, ever been surfing. I don't think I owned a rash guard, but I bought one. A picture of me with a surfboard and the AOA medical students behind me or next to me with the water behind. And so I said yes. And then yesterday on the beach, we did it. I went surfing and I took a surfing lesson. They were all there and I got the photo.
That's perfect. Yeah, add that to the scrapbook.
Oh, are you kidding me? It's gonna be in the front of my website.
So species spanning medicine, that's the topic of your talk. That is the research that you've done for decades at this point. Right now, I think of things like emerging pathogens of One Health, the theory that the human and animal world, environment, Mauka to Makai are all interconnected. Have you felt that your work has become increasingly important?
Yeah, I think there is a growing awareness among physicians, among human medical, not only practitioners, but also biomedical researchers, that trying to understand human health in an overly anthropocentric way, it's a fool's errand, because as you said, the biology of the human and the environment and all the other animals with whom we share the earth is so interconnected that, yeah, if we ignore those other elements, we do so at our peril. It's a scientific blindfold.
What are a few of your favorite examples of some of the things we can learn from animals and the ways that they've adapted to their environments?
Right. So the leading cause of heart failure in women is something called heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. We call it HFpEF. And typically, women who have hypertension, high blood pressure for a long period of time, their ventricle starts to get thick. Right? When you work a muscle, it starts to get thick. But when it gets thick, it starts to get stiff. And so they have this shortness of breath and exercise intolerance. So I wondered, is there an animal that might have evolved adaptations to protect it from the effects of high blood pressure? And I thought of the giraffe, because the giraffe has the highest blood pressure of any animal on Earth. In fact, a normal blood pressure for humans is about 120 over 80. For giraffes, normal blood pressure can be as high as 280 over like 150. And the reason is so hiding in plain sight. If you visualize a giraffe and then imagine the space between its two front legs, that's where its heart is. That's where the left ventricle, the pumping chamber, is. And now visualize where its brain is, right? 3 meters vertically up. So that ventricle needs to pump 3 meters multiple times a minute. And so their hearts are very thick. But giraffe also live on the savanna, and they have to flee predators. And they have to flee between 30 and 40 kilometers an hour. And so whereas my human patients, a woman who has this form of heart failure, she's had high blood pressure, her ventricle has gotten thick, her ventricle has gotten stiff, she is short of breath going from her bed to her bathroom. But this was years ago, I began looking at video of giraffe, and I knew how thick their ventricles were, and yet they flee with ease at these speeds. So I realized giraffe had evolved some special physiology and adaptation that allowed them. We think we know what genes are relevant to this adaptation, and there's a lot of interest in using gene therapy to bring that back to human patients.
Yeah, and so that is kind of part of the discussion when we think about how to create interventions or apply some of the evolutionary learnings that you can see in other animals. But there's also the idea that we've already created medicine that works really well for animals that are quite similar to us in many ways, but we just haven't applied them to humans yet. So tell us about cows.
Okay, you did your homework. This is one of my favorite projects, but I'm rarely asked about it. During the pandemic, I thought, what am I going to focus on? I decided to focus on women's health. So I called the project Female Health Across the Tree of Life. And that's when I looked at breast cancer, ovarian cancer, endometriosis across species. But one of the issues that is huge is lactation. And we know how important, at this point, there is so much data of the benefit of lactation, not just for baby, but also for mom in terms of breast health, possibly dementia protection, right? There's no question. But in America, it's something like less than 10% of women, maybe even be lower than that, are able to breastfeed for the duration recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And one of the big reasons for that is something called mastitis, which is a breast infection, a ductal infection that can be really painful. And if a woman has to stop and go on antibiotics, it can interrupt things. So I got interested in talking to dairy veterinarians because I've been doing this now for quite a while. And what I found is the field of human medicine suffers from a bit of human exceptionalism and professional or physician exceptionalism, which is we don't pay attention to important sources of information and colleagues and disciplines that have that information. So one large source of information is the world of veterinary medicine. So that was what my first book was about. But even beyond that, evolutionary biology is so relevant to medicine and conservation biology and all that stuff. So I went on rounds with this dairy vet from the Central Valley, and then I spent part of the year at Harvard Medical School. Some colleagues there, we began really getting into how the dairy vets prevent mastitis. And for over 100 years, they've been studying this. There is a deep body of research, and they have come up with an incredibly effective strategy, as they call it, the cow side versus the bedside, that's non-invasive, that is very inexpensive and very effective. It's called the California mastitis test. They take a few drops of milk at the time of lactation. They put it on a paddle that has a reagent, and they're looking for the presence of white blood cells. So even before the cow has mastitis, even before she's symptomatic, they can change the milking practices and other non-invasive strategies, and it's highly effective. And I'm thinking, here we have this, it's a public health issue really in women's health. There's this barrier. And why can't we begin bringing all of that research over, all that knowledge, and something as simple and inexpensive and efficacious as this California mastitis test? So that project, yeah, it's a wonderful project because medical students have gotten involved. And there's an intuitiveness about it that's quite lovely. We also really love the idea that people who live in communities, I'm not just talking about commercial dairy vets, that's one thing, but there are so many pastoral communities, people who rely on lactation as their family's source of income. And we began thinking about what they must know about mastitis prevention, right? It's their livelihood. You know that they have thought about this, and they don't have a lot of resources. So again, just widening the window through which we perceive human health to just be broader than the typical, oh, I'm going to go to the lab and study something, study a pathway or a mechanism.
One thing I was thinking about with respect to your women's health research and tapping the experience and knowledge of both people whose livelihoods depend on some of this stuff, but also veterinarians, is whether just the way that medical education works has ended up siloing people who could be learning a lot from each other.
Absolutely. And you could say, in a way, if I had to say what I've been doing for 15 years, it's to change that exact issue. So Catherine Bowers and I wrote the first book, Zubiquity, back, I think we published that in 2012. And in conjunction with that, we launched these Zubiquity conferences where we brought together medical schools and veterinary schools. So we started with UCLA, which is where I was a professor at the time, and UC Davis Vet Med, which is one of the greatest med schools in the world. And we had topics like we had atrial fibrillation, which is a common arrhythmia in humans, but also in some dogs and horses. So we had a veterinary cardiologist present a case of atrial fibrillation in a, I think it was a thoroughbred horse, and we had a human cardiologist present in human, and they talked to each other as peers, because they are peers. They speak the same language, and that was the whole point. And then the audience, of course, were medical students and vet students. And that's been happening now around the country, around the world. There's one coming up in Japan, in Osaka, in October of this year.
Just exciting ways that people can learn from each other. And just wrapping up, thinking about final thoughts.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, we are animals, humans are animals. And so in terms of our health and our vulnerability to disease, we share far more than we don't share. And it's easy to forget that, right? We certainly can focus on the external and then forget about the shared physiology. So none of us is alone. When we contaminate the environment, we put our health and the health of the animals living in and around us at peril. If we don't pay attention to the health of the animals in our lives, whether it's our pets or the birds or the fish or whatever, that if we're not paying attention, we are definitely going to miss early signs of threats. That has happened over and over in recent history, since really we've been documenting the Anthropocene. On the other side of it, biodiversity is worth protecting. And I'm not saying that in a really obvious wagging my finger way. I'm talking as a physician, as someone who is, my life is focused in improving human health, and biodiversity includes physiologic diversity. And we're living at a time when the tools to discover what's out there and to understand it and make the connection back to our species, the tools have never been more powerful.
Yeah. And it just makes me think, in a place like Hawaii, humans have been here maximum a couple thousand years. Plants and animals and microorganisms have been here since the formation, before the formation of the main Hawaiian Islands. So the solutions that they have evolved are just, I mean, way beyond what we could have done in the short time we've been here.
I was just looking at, just to educate myself, the Hawaiian monk seal is a deep diver. And I have a project, we had a paper that looked at, so if you imagine diving deep, what happens? The pressure, right? The pressure gets heavier and heavier headed in towards your head, let's say. Well, the eye, right? The optic nerve is in the back of the eye. We know that in humans who have a disease called glaucoma, the pressure inside the eye gets very high and the optic nerve is damaged. Well, if you're deep diving, the pressure is coming out. So you have to generate high pressure inside the eye to prevent collapse. So those animals, including, I was thinking about the monk seal, I hypothesize have evolved optic nerve adaptations that protect it from high pressure.
That was cardiologist and evolutionary biologist Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. She spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender. Natterson-Horowitz is the author of the books Wildwood and the New York Times bestseller Zubiquity.
Tomorrow is the last day to apply for HPR's Community Advisory Board. We're looking for volunteers from across the islands to help share the future of HPR. Neighbor Island Voices are especially welcome to apply. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
It is a night of mele, ole, and hula, and its focus will be on forbidden places, kapu places, wahikapu. The mission houses historic site and archives, plays host to this event this weekend. It promises to be a night to remember. We invited Kumu Sam Ohugon and curator Mike Smolder to talk about what's in store.
The theme of the concert that's coming up this Saturday is wahikapu, and wahikapu means forbidden places. But, you know, when you think about kapu nowadays, you normally see the kapu keep out, no trespassing sign, and people think that's all it means. But in the traditional sense, kapu is a sacred restriction of behavior. And so when something is kapu, you need to behave in a very specific way around it. For example, the kapu for hi'iaka was to eat the fish from the head to the tail. You couldn't eat it any other way. That was the restricted behavior that was associated with her. But if you associate kapu with a place, it usually means you cannot enter the place unless you know the proper behaviors for entering that place. Oh, and that often involves ceremony and the like. So you think about the wawakua, the realm of the gods, the upland forested areas. The only people that could go up there were the people who specialized in the resources of those places. The kiamanu, the bird catchers, right, would go up into the forest and gather the feathers for featherwork. The kahuna kalaiwa'a, the canoe builder, would go up there and select particular trees. The kahuna la'au lapa'au, the herbal medicine practitioner, would be able to go up and gather those herbs that grew only in those places. And of course, the kumuhula, because the upland forest was the realm of Laka, the goddess patron of the hula, would also be able to enter into the wawakua, which was one of the broad wahikapu, the dichotomy between the waukanaka, the realm of people down below, and the wawakua up above. So wahikapu nowadays can apply to all kinds of things, places that are restricted because they're dangerous to enter, like a ho'olawe, for example. Places that are restricted because they're in private ownership, like the island of Ni'ihau. So to be able to explore wahikapu in chant and dance and mo'olelo is a fascinating thing. And the resources of the Mission Houses Museum go a long way toward exploring the ins and outs and the details of wahikapu.
Well, I love, you know, that concept of the protocol, you know, what is proper. And I know growing up on my home island of Guam, we had a thing where if you were in the boonies in the forest and, you know, you needed to relieve yourself, you had to ask permission of your elders. I'm so sorry, you know, but I need to go to the bathroom, you know. But as a kid, I remember thinking of that. You have to pay respect.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And thanks for mentioning our archival resource, because there's a lot of early missionary accounts going to some of these places, or the places that they visited semi-frequently. Places like Ni'ihau, they go over a few times a year to go preach to the people living there. I actually found a very interesting photograph of Kaho'olawe from 1931 in our archives. We don't think of Kaho'olawe being a sort of a, you know, inhabited place anymore, but, you know, up until into the 20th century, it was. And we were able to find a lot of stuff in our archives related to that.
That's interesting because, you know, now it's off limits just because it has unexploded ordnance. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we were there for a visit, you know, what that was like. You had to take care, about where you were and where you set foot. But, you know, it's also nice to learn about the cultural aspects to heal that island, and whether it's, you know, working with the limu or reforestation, mm-hmm. that the community was coming together to help heal.
Exactly. And that's what's wonderful nowadays, is that the old traditions of proper protocol for entering into special places is building up again. And so for Kaho'olawe, the Proteka Ho'olawe Ohana has their particular chants that you use in order to set foot on the island. And during the Makahiki, there are places where the offerings are made and the Makahiki procession can go. And so it's a wonderful thing to see that connection once again of people to place expressed in the protocols and the behaviors that are appropriate for Wahikapu.
And so, Mike, tell us about how this idea came together.
Mission House has been doing a mele program for many years now. We took a little bit of a break between 2019 during pandemic, and after a program we hosted with Kumuohu and Mahealani Wong and Pohai Souza, we thought, why don't we bring that mele program back? I believe the inspiration was the trip you and your halau took to Niihau, yeah?
That was part of it. Certainly the whole idea of a theme for each mele concert. We did themes on places, like we did one mele concert only about Waianae, and we did another one for other places. Or we did ones about aloha. The theme could be aloha aina, it could be aloha for the ali'i, it could be aloha for ohana. And so each of those mele concerts selected the chants and songs that were specific to that. And so Kumumahea and I were talking with a friend who married into a Ni'ihau family. And in that conversation, we thought, you know, the idea of Wahikapu, of forbidden places, and the songs and stories that go along with them would be a wonderful way to enter into another concert. Mm-hmm. Because it's broad when you think about a place that's too dangerous to go, a place that's restricted because of private ownership, a place that's traditionally been long restricted, like the Wawakua, the upland forested zone, or indeed the platform of a large heiau. Who is supposed to be there? What kinds of protocols are necessary to be there? What kind of kuleana, what kind of responsibility comes with each of those different kinds of wahikapu? And for each of them, there are songs and chants and stories that can be told and shared.
There's some, I think, mystique, right, about the areas where you're not supposed to go.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think this is a way for us to, for people who can't go to those places, I think this is a way for us to explore not only the concept of kapu, but also get some of the historical and cultural context of those places and why they're kapu and what makes them so special.
Sam, what can you tell us about the research or the knowledge that you pulled, you know, from other kumu, other resources?
I will say that when we mentioned that we were going to do Wahikapu and we were thinking about Ni'ihau, a friend of mine, Mike Damota, who was a longtime colleague in conservation, actually, but who married into a Ni'ihau family. And when he did, his new uncles took him all around the island, told him the stories of each of these places on the island of Ni'ihau, stories that nobody knows except for the people of Ni'ihau. That is what goes along with a wahikapu. If it's restricted, only a small number of people will know about these things. And so in proper Hawaiian fashion, he decided to write a song for each of those places. So each verse is a different place and why it's special and what's going on there. And when we saw that, he was actually thinking of making it a chant at first. But Kumumahea and I took a look at it, and she said by the end of his going through each of those verses, she had a melody in mind already. And so she started singing the lyrics to that song. And so we decided to record it. And when we recorded it and he took that song back to Ni'ihau, they said, oh, who was that? That's beautiful, right? And so, and then that inspired us further. And he said, well, if you're going to include my song in this concert, then your halau needs to go to Ni'ihau. And so he arranged with Ni'ihau helicopter to fly over the course of 2 days, because you can only fit five people in a helicopter at a time, over the course of 2 days to fly our entire halau to Ni'ihau so we could experience that place, actually stand on that wahikapu.
Wow.
So that's the kind of extra connection that we were able to garner in our research on that place.
Yeah, but so it's the telling of the story of Ni'ihau, I guess through the eyes of an outsider being brought in and sharing the story of the place, the sense of place.
Well, yeah, and the nice thing is that we have an insider who had written that song. And so to be able to share his song with people who would normally not be able to hear that at all and celebrate each of those places with the folks that come to the concert, that's going to be a delightful honor for us.
Yeah, so Mike, you know, I know you have so many different programs that you put on there mm-hmm. at the mission houses. You know,
the Pupu Theater is always an amazing event to learn about our history, to watch history come alive.
Indeed. Besides the Mele Vahikapu coming up in June for the last three weekends, we have our Oahu Cemetery Pupu Theater called Visions of Hospitality, and we'll be focusing on the history of the hospitality and tourism industries. So we always portray five different people there in the cemetery, sort of like dinner theater in the cemetery. This year for the hospitality industry, we'll be doing Alexander Young of the Alexander Young Hotel, the first hotel magnate here in Honolulu. We'll be doing Mrs. Governor McCarthy, Margaret McCarthy, who ran a place called the Donna. It was an apartment hotel with several cottages on the corner of Baratania and Pi'ikoi, which she started before her husband became governor in 1918. And continued to exist at least through the 1950s and 60s. And then we're doing Manuia, who is a cousin of Governor Boki in the 1820s. He and Boki ran a number of grog shops and boarding house type things down by the harbor. Manuia also accompanied Liholiho and Queen Kamamalu to London as well. He's actually the one who catches measles first there in London. And then when they get back, he starts all these businesses. So I think that really shows sort of the adaptability of Native Hawaiians in this early 1800s period and how they're interfacing with foreigners coming here.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating just to be able to take that concept of hospitality as we know it today, but then to explore the history and the culture behind it. Will you be involved in any of this?
I enjoy watching from the side. These programs are amazingly educational for the folks that participate in them. But you were asking about sources. And the other thing is that we get to draw upon the traditional training that Kumu John Lake offered us. And among them are many protocols for entry and behavior on heiau, the protocols for entering the forest, and for gathering herbs and or lay material therein. And so to be able to share that a decade or more of training under a traditional master of protocol and ceremony is another aspect that adds depth to the concert that we'll be presenting. You know, normally when you think about a concert, you think about sitting down and being entertained for an hour. But with the mission houses, it's always an educational experience. You're going to go there and learn. You're going to take a deep dive into the subject matter of each concert.
Yeah, well, you just appreciate the place that we call home.
Absolutely. And for us to be able to draw on our own archives as well to help supplement what is being talked about is really neat because in some cases, these missionaries, you know, these early 1800s missionaries are some of the earliest accounts by foreigners going to some of these places and interacting with the people there. And so to have these, you know, really early accounts is something also that doesn't get brought out terribly often.
Yeah, original source. Mm-hmm. But thank you so much, gentlemen, for spending time with us today.
Oh, our pleasure.
Oh, mahalo nui.
And that was Kumu Sam Ohugon and Mike Smolik, a curator of the Mission Houses Museum Historic Site, talking to us about Saturday evening's event entitled Wahi Kapu. Look for links for more information on our website later today. Well, that does it for us for now. Up tomorrow, we hear about the on-again, off-again, three-digit tariffs, how they're affecting, wait for it, kaboom, fireworks. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.